Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. World powers have agreed on a plan for a cessation of hostilities in Syria, but they've stopped short of securing a ceasefire, a move sought by the Syrian opposition to end Russian airstrikes on rebel-held Aleppo. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has a story from Munich.
After a flurry of bilateral meetings, a full international Syria support group sat down and crafted a plan to launch a cessation of hostilities targeted to begin in 1 week.
That's ambitious, but everybody is determined to move as rapidly as possible to try to achieve this.
In a news conference with his Russian counterpart and the UN envoy, Kerry said a ceasefire carried legal prerogatives that would not apply to a cessation. The group also said the cessation would not apply to terrorist organizations, some of which were near the besieged city of Aleppo, according to Russia. The group agreed to expand relief efforts in Syria, where a humanitarian crisis has worsened as a result of the Russian-backed Syrian government bombings over Aleppo, which have forced thousands of civilians to seek refuge near the Turkish border. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Munich.
The UN mission in Mali says three peacekeeping troops were killed Friday in an attack on a base in the northern town of Kidal. UN mission head Mohamed Saleh Anadif says 30 other people were wounded in the early morning attack. UN mission sources say suspected Islamist militants fired rockets at the camp. The French news agency reports that the dead peacekeepers are from Guinea. In his statement, UN mission head Anadif expressed outrage at what he called a hateful and irresponsible act. Please look at our website at voanews.com. VOA News. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is to meet with the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, Friday at a security conference in Munich. The meeting occurs after the Western Military Alliance and the United States announced plans for the biggest military buildup in Europe since the Cold War. The United States is set to quadruple military spending in Europe to $3.4 billion in 2017 as NATO increases troops on rotation and training, stockpiles military hardware and arms, and forms a rapid reaction force. Russia has called NATO's moves a threat to stability in Europe. The military alliance says the news plans are aimed at reassuring Eastern European allies concerned about Russian aggression. Pakistan announced it has dismantled al-Qaeda's main network in South Asia and foiled plans to break out of jail a man involved in the murder of journalist Daniel Pearl. Lieutenant General Asim Bajwa, the spokesman for Pakistan's military, said they've arrested 97 militants, including Farooq Bhatti, also known as Mosana, the deputy chief of al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, 12 of the group's financiers, and 15 explosive experts. Bajwa said the head of this al-Qaeda chapter is in Afghanistan. He said Pakistan has also arrested senior leadership of a banned militant outfit, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, along with 10 of the group's IED experts and 6 suicide bombers. The two U.S. Democratic presidential candidates appear to be working harder at convincing voters they are the candidate for all people, especially middle-class Americans. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders held another debate Thursday night in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and the intensity of the race was on immediate display.
The kind of criticism that we've heard from Senator Sanders about our president, I expect from Republicans. I do not expect from someone running for the Democratic nomination to succeed President
Obama.
Madam Secretary, that is a low blow. One of us ran against Barack Obama. I was not that candidate.
The verbal bars have increased as Clinton tries to rebound from Sanders' landslide victory in New Hampshire earlier this week. Pope Francis, head of the Roman Catholic Church, arrives in Cuba Friday for a historic meeting with the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill. Kirill is in Cuba for a state visit. The Holy See says Pope Francis will make a stop at Havana's Jose Marti International Airport to have a personal conversation with the Patriarch. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Our relatively poor knowledge of the Zika virus presents a series of challenges for R&D. However, I'm pleased to say that based on our experience with research and development during the West Africa Ebola epidemic, WHO's R&D response is proceeding very quickly for Zika.
And that's World Health Organization Assistant Director General Dr. Marie Polikini talking about Zika virus research and development efforts. Details coming up also in the news. A UN official in Mali says militants have attacked a UN base in Kidal in northern Mali, killing at least three people and injuring 30 others. And Southern Sudan President Salva Kiir has reappointed his rival, rebel leader Riek Machar, as first vice president in a coalition government. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says major powers have agreed to seek an end to hostilities in Syria to begin in 1 week's time. Kerry says the cessation of hostilities will not apply to terrorist groups, including Islamic State, Al-Nusra, and others. He says the 17-nation International Syria Support Group has agreed that a task force co-chaired by the U.S. and Russia will work on methods for long-term reduction in violence. Jan Egeland, the chairman of the UN humanitarian meeting in Germany, says it could be the breakthrough we've been waiting for. However, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has cautioned the world's powers about committing their troops to any ground action in Syria. Also, Syrian rebels warn their five-year-long struggle to oust President Bashar al-Assad will go underground if they are deserted by Western backers or an attempt is made to force an unacceptable political deal on them. The European Union says visa-free travel between its EU states is at risk due to the migrant and refugee crisis. The EU also accuses Greece of not being able to protect the bloc's external borders. Travel without visas within Europe has been one of the EU bloc's most cherished economic benefits. However, the migrant crisis forced some temporary border closures. Even with EU help, Greece has struggled to register migrants and relocate or deport them. Most of the more than a million migrants and refugees who have entered Europe in the past 18 months have come from Turkey and crossed the Aegean to the Greek islands. The UN Refugee Agency says over 80,000 refugees and migrants arrived in Europe by boat during the first 6 weeks of 2016. And over 400 have died trying to cross. Despite rougher seas, harsh winter weather, and numerous hardships, more than 2,000 people a day continue to risk their lives and the lives of their children attempting to reach Europe. More people arrived during the first 6 weeks of 2016 than during the first 4 months of 2015. The government of Rwanda says it is going to relocate Burundi refugees to other countries. The announcement follows U.S. accusations that Rwandan officials are using the refugees to build political opposition to Burundi's president. The government says it will immediately begin working with partners in the international community to plan the orderly relocation of Burundians who fled to Rwanda to escape political violence. However, no country has committed yet to taking the refugees. In a statement today, Rwanda says it readily shoulders its obligations to protect and care for refugees. However, it adds that the long-term presence of the refugees carries considerable risks for all involved. Also, sources say Burundi will not chair the upcoming summit of the East African Community. A top government official says the summit is not a priority at this time. Burundi was expected to take over from neighboring Tanzania late this month during the EAC Heads of State Summit and begin a one-year term as chair. But a top government official speaking on conditions of anonymity says that his country's top priority now is to end the insecurity that has rocked the country since last year. Ambassador Jean-Claude Nsengiama was first Burundian to hold an executive position in the East African Community as the Deputy Secretary General for 6 years. He agrees with the government's decision.
As a former officer of the East African Community Secretariat, in my experience, I think this is not probably the right time for the Republic of Burundi to chair community meetings. But again, that is my own views, not necessarily the government views, because I do not speak for the Burundi government.
This comes as violence in Bujumbura continues with grenade attacks in public areas and targeted killings of civilians by armed groups. Burundi security forces have continued forced disarmament operations in the capital in order to try to end the current wave of violence.
I think Burundi is going through security issues that the priority of the government now. The reason why I say this is that to chair means you have to have enough time to read and prepare issues that will be discussed in the meetings across the sectors of EAC integration process. When you have a situation at national level that requires full concentration at home, you can probably surrender to chair regional meetings, and it's not a treaty violation.
The chairmanship in the East African Community operates on the rotational basis. The presidents of the member states chair for 1 year period. With the summit expected to take place late this month, poor relations between Burundi and Rwanda are expected to be on the agenda. The United States envoy for the Africa Great Lakes region, Thomas Perriello, says that there are credible reports of rebel recruitment of Burundian refugees in camps in Rwanda to participate in armed attacks against the government. Once again, Ambassador Nsengiama.
My opinion, and according to what we read in the news and international reports like UN report, some refugees being from Burundi, being trained in another country and come and attack their own country, I think it's a big problem that assume can be discussed in the summit. Normally, two countries accusing each other kind of activities to destabilize another country, I think that can be a serious agenda item, a very sensitive one that I don't see how it won't be discussed.
Hundreds of people have died in violence in Burundi since last April, when President Nkurunziza said he would run for a third term. Critics called it unconstitutional and a violation of the Arusha Peace Accords. About 250,000 Burundians have fled to other countries. With only a week until national elections in Uganda, a number of human rights advocates are concerned about increasingly violent rhetoric coming from the nation's leaders. Elizabeth Polat has more from Kampala.
Ugandans reacted in shock last month when Inspector General of Police Kale Kayihura was quoted by a local newspaper saying that if the opposition wanted war, they would give crime preventers, a youth force created to supplement the police, guns. Then, not long after, the Secretary General of the ruling NRM party, Kasule Lumumba, was heard on the radio telling citizens that the state will kill your children should they protest election results. Although both Kayihura and Lumumba say they were misquoted, many feel the official response to these statements has been inadequate. Patrick Tumwin, a program officer with Human Rights Network Uganda, says such rhetoric has also been made by resident district commissioners, who are appointed by the president to oversee local communities.
If this is not stopped, the Electoral Commission does not come out strongly to condemn and also stop different camps, different candidates stop making hate speech and statements that are likely to cause violence. It's the Secretary General of the ruling party, the NRM, making serious statements saying that they will kill and shoot people. And we've also not only heard that has made a statement, most of the RDCs in different parts of the country have made same statements. And so that is a cause for worry. The Jinja RDC, for example, gave the same statements, warned people that they will shoot their children if they go to the streets. So it's a threat that they are trying to do. Is it a warning? Is it planned?
The potential for violence, however, has been hotly contested by the police, who say local media have misquoted and latched onto certain issues to inflate the problem. Fred Enanga, a spokesperson with the Ugandan Police Force, explains.
We really meet every other day to evaluate how our deployment actually is. Are there any early warning signs? And we've actually managed to carry out very, very peaceful political activities. As we talk now, we've policed over 900 presidential and parliamentary campaigns. And out of those, we've had less than 10 cases where violence was registered. Those ones who have fallen off using politics of fear and trying to discourage certain sections of the voters, please don't go, there's going to be violence, you need to stock sugar. Don't come out of your homes, on social media, which is even very damaging.
Yet controversial imaging in campaign ads, such as skulls and talk of war, have citizens on edge. Human Rights Watch has called on President Yoweri Museveni and other high-ranking officials to unambiguously call for peace and reaffirm the right to freedom of assembly. So far, the nation's leaders have not commented on the issue. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Seventeen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A UN official in Mali says militants have attacked a UN base in Kidal in northern Mali, killing at least three people and injuring 30 others. Reuters says a resident reports seeing UN helicopters fly overhead and hearing gunfire and the sound of explosions. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but the Islamist extremist group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has claimed credit for recent attacks. Meanwhile, in Niger, a military intelligence officer says thousands of Islamic State fighters in neighboring Libya are moving south into the Sahel. He says the militants are leaving their stronghold on the Libyan coast to escape the threat of Western airstrikes. The intelligence officer says these increases security threats in Chad, Niger, and Mali, a region already struggling with militants from Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda. Two former prime ministers of the Central African Republic meet in a runoff presidential election Sunday, but exiled former President François Bozizé remains a major force in the nation hit by years of sectarian violence. Bozizé was ousted in 2013 by Muslim Salaka rebels. He escaped to Uganda as Christian militias formed to confront the rebels. Bozizé, a former military officer who came to power in a coup, was barred from running for president again. However, he remains the head of the largest political party. South Sudan President Salva Kiir has reappointed his rival, rebel leader Riek Machar, as first vice president in a coalition government. A presidential spokesman says the president expects Machar to travel to South Sudan's capital, Juba, soon. Machar tells VOA that he welcomes the appointment and considers it a good step towards bringing political stability to South Sudan. He says the next thing to do is to move quickly to complete the formation of the transitional government. Machar's appointment is part of a peace deal signed by the two leaders last August. Despite the deal, sporadic fighting has continued and a humanitarian crisis has worsened. A top World Health Organization official gave an update today on the Zika virus and what's being done about it. Assistant Director General Dr. Marie-Paule Kinney talked about WHO efforts on research and development.
Our relatively poor knowledge of the Zika virus presents a series of challenges for R&D. However, I'm pleased to say that based on our experience with research and development during the West Africa Ebola epidemic, WHO's R&D response is proceeding very quickly for Zika. After Ebola, WHO began to draw up a master plan for research and development to both prepare for health emergencies and to be able to mount a fast R&D response in case of needs. The R&D blueprint, as the initiative is called, aims to accelerate the availability of medical countermeasures during epidemics and limit damages as much as possible.
She says the WHO has established what she calls a critical path for coordinated action with private industry to address Zika. This includes vaccine research.
For vaccines, the landscape is evolving very rapidly and numbers change daily. About 15 companies of groups have been identified by WHO so far, and most have only just started work. Two vaccine candidates seem to be more advanced. One is a DNA vaccine from the US National Institute for Health, and the second is an inactivated product from Bharat Biotech, an Indian vaccine manufacturer. Of course, the current absence of standardized animal models and reagents is slowing down development, but many people are working towards having this reagent ready as soon as possible. But in spite of this encouraging landscape, vaccines are at least 18 months away from large-scale trials.
Dr. Kinney also says research continues to find a reliable diagnostic test for Zika. Numerous companies are working on that.
Although it is difficult to predict the time for the first commercial and independently validated tests to be available, but here we are talking weeks and not years.
The WHO official says controlling the mosquito population known as vector control is also part of the plan.
For vector control, innovative methods seem promising options. For example, biological approaches such as the controlled release of bacteria to prevent viral replication of Zika virus in mosquitoes, or genetic approaches such as the release of genetic modified mosquitoes to reduce the mosquito population. In terms of what happens afterwards, when potential products reach an advanced stage of testing and show promising data, we have in place the WHO emergency assessment and listing procedure for the use of experimental products during an epidemic. The accelerated assessment process was established during the Ebola epidemic and aims to ensure that products meet acceptable levels of quality, safety, and efficacy, even if evaluation is fast-tracked, before they are rolled out in countries.
That's World Health Organization Assistant Director General Dr. Marie-Paule Kinney. She spoke today in Geneva. A high court in Malawi has ordered the annulment of a 2012 government moratorium issued that suspended a law criminalizing homosexual acts. The government had suspended enforcement of the anti-gay laws pending parliamentary review after rights campaigners said the laws were unconstitutional. Lamik Masina reports from Blantyre.
The court's order to enforce the anti-gay laws comes 2 months after government authorities ordered the police to respect the moratorium by unconditionally pardoning two suspected gays who were arrested in December last year in the capital, Lilongwe. Three pastors filed a suit in the northern city of Nzuzu, saying that by pardoning the gay suspects, the government was applying the penal code selectively. They argued that the government suspension of the anti-homosexuality law was illegal. George Katsivatik is the lawyer representing the three pastors.
Our main arguments have been that the executive branch of government, the Minister of Justice, the Director of Public Prosecutions, and the Malawi Police Service do not have the mandate to change the position of any law in the country.
He says only the Malawi Parliament has the mandate to change or suspend any law in the country. In Malawi, homosexuality is an offense punishable by up to 14 years in prison.
And having regard to the penal code, which prohibits acts of homosexuality in the country, that act of parliament was not amended or repealed in any way by the Malawi parliament. So it is still in force and it has to be applied.
When announcing the order this week, Judge Dingiswayo Madise said the arrest should continue until there is a judicial review of the government's decision to stop the prosecution of the gay people in Malawi. Timothy Ntambo was a campaigner for minority rights and also the executive director for the NGO Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation. He says the court's position on the matter is worrying.
These laws are cake and democratic, and these laws are not laws that are supposed to be implemented in a nation that has got a human rights regime.
He said his organization is ready to support any group that will challenge the court's order, which he says will force the country's more than 40,000 homosexuals to suffer in silence over fear of being arrested.
When there was a moratorium, you saw a number of members of the LGBTI community even coming in public, demanding their rights to say, I am gay and I'm demanding the rights. So this time around, it's like we're going back to square zero.
A spokesman for Presbyterian Church in the Northern Malawi, Reverend Morris Muntali, welcomes the High Court order.
Rights should not be a hiding leaf for people to commit sin. What we're saying is everything that is unlawful should not be turned into a right.
Government authorities say they will announce their position on the court's order once they go through the court's documents. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou discusses female circumcision, also known as female genital cutting. Our guest is Angela M. Peabody, president and founder of Global Woman Peace Foundation. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa. VOA!
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says major powers have agreed to seek an end to hostilities in Syria. A UN official in Mali says militants have attacked a UN base in Kidal in northern Mali, killing at least three people and injuring 30 others. And South Sudan President Salva Kiir has reappointed his rival rebel leader Riek Machar as first vice president in a coalition government. Coming up, music from South Africa. And in our feature segment, screening and distributing local films in Zimbabwe. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand there's a big football vote coming up in your report.
Yehiz, we're now exactly 2 weeks away to the FIFA presidential election in Zurich, Switzerland. At stake is arguably the most powerful position in international sports, head of world football's governing body. There are five candidates: Gianni Infantino of Switzerland, Jerome Champagne of France, Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa of Bahrain, Tokyo Sekwale of South Africa, and Prince Ali bin Al Hussein of Jordan. Prince Ali is warning FIFA will no longer be able to credibly govern world football if it does not clean up its act. Lisa Schlein tells us more from Geneva.
FIFA's long-serving president, Sepp Blatter, was forced to step down after the organization he led for 17 years became mired in scandal last year. A new president will be chosen on February 26th from a list of five candidates. Prince Ali Al Hussein, who is in the running, says the election will be FIFA's last chance to turn its back on the shame and turmoil of the past and turn a new page. He warns business as usual is no longer possible. He says a real and visible change in the culture of the organization must take place to ward off the worst.
If we don't do that, the outside forces that have already affected FIFA will only grow stronger. Governments will step up their investigations, more sponsors will walk away, and more revenue will be lost.
The United States has indicted 14 officials and associates of FIFA on wire fraud, racketeering, and money laundering charges. In a separate action, Swiss authorities have launched a criminal inquiry into FIFA's controversial awarding of the 2018 and 2022 World Cups to Russia and Qatar. Prince Ali says his reform plan will turn FIFA into a transparent, ethical, and democratic organization that is accountable to governments, associations, and the public. For starters, he says he will propose a limit of 2 4-year consecutive terms for FIFA president and members of the executive committee. He says he will disclose top salaries. If elected president, he says he will immediately contact the Swiss and U.S. attorney generals to offer cooperation to reach a swift conclusion to their investigations. He says FIFA, under his presidency, would no longer be ruled by fear and intimidation.
Let me tell you what happens when you don't go with the recognized powers in FIFA. Development projects mysteriously stall. Tournament hosting bids are suddenly compromised or withdrawn. National teams start to mysteriously face less favorable fixtures and even referees. All of these are effective ways to punish member associations that fail to demonstrate political loyalty.
Prince Ali says FIFA's 209 members know the organization is in crisis. He says the presidential election on February 26th is critical, as it will determine whether a small group of powerful individuals will hold FIFA hostage. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thanks, Lisa. Just ahead on the sunny side of sports, my VOA colleague James Buddy will have a Black History Month segment on one of basketball's greatest players.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for Black History Month facts for today, February 12th. On this day in 1934, retired American professional basketball player William Felton Bill Russell was born in West Monroe, Louisiana. He played for the Boston Celtics of the National Basketball Association, NBA, from 1956 to 1969. The five-time NBA Most Valuable Player, Russell was the centerpiece of the Celtics dynasty, winning 11 NBA championships during his 13-year career. Along with Henry Richard of the National Hockey League's Montreal Canadiens, Russell holds the record for the most championship won by an athlete in a North American sports league.
Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny.
Andrew, what's trending in the sports world on this Friday?
Well, the name Adam Johnson has been trending for the past couple of days. Now, Adam Johnson is a 28-year-old English footballer, formerly of the Sunderland Football Club.
Okay.
Of course, EPL is huge around the world, so a lot of interest in that. But Adam Johnson pled guilty to having a physical relationship with an underage girl, and so this has been trending as his trial has proceeded. A lot of social media reaction to this, people ranging from sadness over the situation, disgust, and the one comment I thought was very interesting, someone tweeted out and said, "Millions of young men dream of playing in the EPL and dream of playing football." And he, Adam Johnson, had this dream and kind of gave it away. So that really struck a chord, I think, with a lot of people on social media that he had this great life, this great career, and then threw it away.
Yeah, I imagine Sunderland fans have to kind of in mourning on this Friday.
I think so, and it's the interesting thing, not just within England, but like I said, around the world, there's so much interest. There are Sunderland fans all over the world. There are EPL fans all over the world. So there's a lot of global interest to the story, and that's why it's one of the top global trending terms on Twitter today.
Andrew, let me remind our Voice of America listeners, in terms of Twitter, you can send me tweets at VOA Sunny Sports. At VOA Sunny Sports is my handle. And my Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Andrew, let me share a few Facebook messages I received on Friday. My friend Vincent Maloba writes from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Vincent is a constable for the Kenya Police Diplomats Protection Unit, and he's also known as the beat cop for the Sunny Side of Sports. I must admit, Andrew, I always feel safer when the beat cop is on patrol in Nairobi.
Absolutely.
Vincent says he tunes in the Sunny Side of Sports and other VOA programming on 107.5 FM, the Voice of America's 24/7 FM affiliate in Kenya's capital. In Vincent's words, "I'm taking my seat as usual on this Friday evening, Sunny, to hear your show." Thanks for writing, Vincent. And Gona Aaron Geaton sent me another Facebook message from Zambia. And Aaron correctly points out that on this day 4 years ago, February 12th, 2012, the Chipolo Polo of Zambia won their first Africa Cup of Nations football trophy, beating Ivory Coast 8-7 on penalty kicks in Libreville, Gabon. Thanks for writing, Aaron, and a shout out for the Chipolo Polo of Zambia. Andrew, what else is trending in sports?
Well, turning from football to American football, Peyton Manning, of course, just won the Super Bowl with the Denver Broncos. Congratulations to him. But Peyton wasn't necessarily the top topic on social media. It was his brother, Eli. Now, okay. Eli Manning is
also a quarterback.
Also a quarterback for the New York Giants. And Eli Manning was watching his brother play in the Super Bowl, and Peyton Manning's Denver Broncos scored a touchdown, and they cut to Eli Manning and the Peyton and Eli Manning family. And Eli just looked so defeated and dejected. And this quickly spread across social media as a meme, people saying he couldn't even be happy for his brother. Well, Peyton's finally come out now on the Tonight Show. He went on there to making the rounds on the talk shows. And Peyton has said, well, Eli told me that he was actually contemplating the game, and that's why he had that look on his face. He was thinking, should he go for one extra point, the kick, or should they go for two extra points and try to run it into the end zone on the extra points after that touchdown? So that was the explanation for that face, but a lot of social media reaction to that. As interesting as we've talked about before, with things like the Super Bowl, with these big sporting events, you never quite know what social media is going to seize on. And in this case, it was Eli Manning's reaction.
I was wondering if maybe Eli was dejected that his older brother has now tied him in terms of Super Bowl trophies.
That's funny, because that was the joke that everyone made on social media, that they would put the picture of Eli Manning's face and say, oh, I'm not the favorite son anymore. Or, oh, I guess we're tied now with number of Super Bowl wins. I'm not the top winner in the family. So it was interesting that a lot of people made a lot of jokes about that.
And just a reminder for our VOA football fans, American style football, Peyton Manning's Denver Broncos defeated the Carolina Panthers 24-10 in the 50th Super Bowl played in Santa Clara, California. And now Eli and Peyton are tied. I think Eli has won two Super Bowl trophies with the New York Giants, but that's quite a family rivalry there.
It is, for sure, and it's one that may not continue, though, because one of the other things that social media is talking about is Peyton Manning. What is he going to do now that he's won this second Super Bowl? He's 39 years old. He was the oldest quarterback to play in a Super Bowl, let alone win a Super Bowl, and there's a lot of questions about his future, whether he's going to retire. At the end of the Super Bowl, a couple of journalists asked him on the field, said, do you have a big announcement you want to make? And he said, I'm going to take some time and think about it. So social media is all over that. They're wondering, is he going to retire? Is he not? I think most people are leaning towards, I think he's probably going to retire. He's going to go out on top. He's already, you know, the oldest quarterback to win a Super Bowl. He may not want to risk any more injury to try to win another one at the age of 40. 39 is probably the good time to go out.
Another athlete, Andrew, parallels to Peyton Manning. He's on his last leg, so to speak, in the sports world. Kobe Bryant, who has announced that this will be his final season in the National Basketball Association. Kobe will be in Toronto, Canada this weekend for the NBA's 65th annual All-Star Game. This will be Kobe's 18th All-Star appearance. Only one other player, retired great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, has made more with 19. But Kobe definitely has a following on Twitter, doesn't he?
I think Kobe has more Twitter followers than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, it's safe to say. Kobe Bryant has about 8.6 million Twitter followers, so a huge audience on social media, a champion that he is.
And once again, that game will be played on Sunday at the Air Canada Center in Toronto, the NBA's 65th annual All-Star Game. Andrew Polcheski, VOA social media reporter, thanks for joining us again on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to be here.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yeheyas Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny. Thank you, Andrew. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, UNESCO offering literacy classes for officers in South Sudan's National Police Force. And next, screening and distributing local film production in Zimbabwe. But for some music, here is Zahara from South Africa with Umatawalo. South Africa's Zahara Umatawalo. In South Sudan, the United Nations Education Program, UNESCO, is offering literacy classes for officers in Juba's South Sudan National Police Force. Nabil Biagio reports from Juba. The program is being supported by the South Sudan Ministry of Education.
30 teachers have been taught how to teach other officers how to read and write English during a five-day program at the Juba Regency Hotel. Salah Khalid, UNESCO's representative in South Sudan, talked about the importance of police officers learning how to communicate in English at today's ceremony at police headquarters in Buluk.
If the men and women around this room, together with all the officers in the police service, are responsible to implement the law, are responsible and required to assume their duties and functions on a day-to-day basis, respecting human rights, civic rights, how can we expect them to assume this extremely important role in our everyday life within the communities, within the society, if any of them does not have the ability to read and write?
About half of Juba's police force cannot read or write, according to official sources. The illiteracy rate runs at as high as 80% in other states around the country. Khalid says the program puts an emphasis on teaching the English language to police officers.
And if, by constitution, English is the national language, the first national language, we know that many of you here have learned in Khartoum, studied in Khartoum in Arabic, and you find some difficulty in dealing now in English. And this is why it is extremely important for us also to work on that side.
Major James Dack is one of the participants in the training who will work to eradicate illiteracy in Juba's police force.
We have been told about adult literature program. Also, we have been told the functional adult literature, setting up literature center. We also been told about learning environment, an approach to literature. We've also been told how to assess and evaluate and report. We have been taught alphabets, including in vernacular.
Dak says he would have liked the training program to last longer. Nonetheless, he says he and the other participants are ready to start teaching English to their illiterate colleagues.
All these topics that we have covered, we are going to implement them when we are going to start training literature in our police institution. And we have extended invitation to all our unit and institutions for those who are interested to join this marvel course.
Michael Lopuke, Undersecretary at the Ministry of Education, says his ministry has high hopes for the program.
We aim at training over 5,000 police force. Will exert effort, very serious effort, in supporting this process. That we are not only going to let you know how to read and write, but to make a difference. We are going to enable those who aspire to go for specialized course in the universities be able to make it.
Lupoke says such literacy programs are part of his government's plans to build a strong nation.
We are trying to empower. If you see, there are literacy for empowerment.
Of the estimated 45,000 police officers in South Sudan, about 20,000 of them are in and around Juba. Facilitators promise to extend the program to other police officers in South Sudan, as well as other organized forces across the country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
In Zimbabwe, a censorship board has granted a license to a local theater company to screen and distribute local film productions at its newly constructed theater in the Park Cinema venue. VOA correspondent Erwin Chifera reports from Harare.
Rooftop Promotions Director Davis Kuja said the new 600-seater theater in the park, being constructed with the support of various embassies in the country, would also offer live streaming of all its productions and shows while offering free rehearsals to Harare-based theater companies.
This theater
has now been licensed as of 10 days ago as a cinema venue that focuses primarily on local production. Only local. The censorship board was very kind to us to give us that certification, I can assure you.
He said the venue that opens next month would have a kiosk stocked with rooftop productions and various artists' works dating back to more than two decades. Apart from theatre and cinema, the venue would boost the growth of theatrical products and musicals within Zimbabwe and the Southern African Development Community region. Guja said a regular program called State of the Nation that will explore the week's news and topical issues, providing space for dialogue between citizens and policymakers, would be offered every Friday. Theatre writer Stephen Chifunyise said the arts industry was very vibrant but could be better with more marketing.
What is required is the marketing and the pricing system that allows for a better method of encouraging more people to consume the arts.
Renowned musician Oliver Mtukudzi said the new theatre in the park was a necessity which must be replicated in other towns and cities.
It's a necessity. It is a necessity. We need more of this. I wish we could have such things in every city of our country.
National Arts Council Director Elvis Marie said the new venue was a game changer as it comes at a time when space for arts is limited in all parts in the country.
We are of the view that more spaces of this nature can and should be created not only in Harare but in other parts of the country.
The new $1 million theater would use solar energy and its productions are set to focus on productions that work to close gaps between policymakers, inventors, and citizens in adopting renewable energy. This is Ivan Kifera.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Zabir Taibi. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including the Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shekau. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Chacao's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net, or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.